We were looking at verses 5 to 12, chapter 2. David instructs Solomon to deal with these three individuals, Joab, Barzillai, and Shimei. We discussed Joab. Second one is Barzillai. You read in verse 7, but show kindness to the sons of Barzillai of Gilead, and let them be among those who eat at your table. They stood by me when I fled from your brother Absalom. When David had to flee from Jerusalem, he received assistance from Barzillai. You find that in 2 Samuel 17, 27 to 29, where you read, when David came to Mahanaim, Shobi, son of Nahash, from Reba of the Ammonites, Machir, son of Amiel, from Lodabar, and Barzillai, the Gileadite, from Rogalim, brought bedding and bowls and articles of pottery. They also brought wheat and barley, flour and roasted grain, beans and lentils, honey and curd, sheep and cheese from cow's milk for David and his people to eat, for they said, these people have become hungry and are tired and thirsty in the desert. Later, when David was about to return to Jerusalem, Barzillai met him and sent him on his way. In 2 Samuel 19:31, you read of that. Barzillai the Gileadite came down from Rogalim to cross the Jordan with the king and to send him on his way from there. Now, Barzillai was a very old man, 80 years of age. He had provided for the king during his stay in Mahanaim, for he was a very wealthy man. And the king said, cross over with me and stay in Jerusalem, and I will provide you. But Barzillai said he didn't want to do that. But in any case, he was of great encouragement to David. And he had acted loyally to David at a time when it seemed that Absalom would be victorious. He had come to assist David when it seemed that Absalom would be victorious. In other words, he did that at great risk. You're going to get yourself involved in taking sides in a revolution. You want to be pretty sure, if you're interested in your own self-preservation, to make sure you're on the right side. But at great risk, Barzillai came and he helped David, even though it appeared at that point that David was on the run. And David had not forgotten that. And his loyalty here is rewarded. And he wants the family of Barzillai to be rewarded for his faithfulness. So he tells Solomon to show kindness to these people and to have them eat at his table. Shimei is the third individual. Verse 8 says, remember, you have with you Shimei, son of Gera the Benjaminite, from Bahurim, who called down bitter curses on me the day I went to Mahanaim. When he came down to meet me at the Jordan, I swore to him by the Lord, I will not put you to death by the sword. But now, do not consider him innocent. You are a man of wisdom. You will know what to do to him. Bring his gray head down to the grave in blood. When David fled from Absalom, he was met by Shimei. That's in 2 Samuel 16, 5-4, or 5-14. 2 Samuel 16, 5-14. Shimei was a distant relative of Saul. And you read in verse 5 of 2 Samuel 16, as King David approached Bahurim, a man from the same clan as Saul's family came out there. His name was Shimei, son of Gera. He cursed as he came out. He pelted David and all the king's officials with stones, though all the troops and the special guard were on David's right and left. As he cursed, Shimei said, get out, you man of blood, you scoundrel. The Lord has repaid you for all the blood you shed in the household of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. The Lord has handed the kingdom over to your son Absalom. You have come to ruin because you are a man of blood. Abishai, son of Zeruiah, said to the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and cut off his head. But the king said, what do you and I have in common, you sons of Zeruiah? If he is cursing because the Lord said to him, curse David, who can ask, why do you do this? David then said to Abishai and all his officials, my son, who is of my own flesh, is trying to take my life. How much more than this Benjamin? Leave him alone. Let him curse. For the Lord has told him to. It may be that the Lord will see my distress and repay me with good for the cursing I am receiving today. So David and his men continued along the road while Shimei was going along the hillside opposite him, cursing as he went, throwing stones at him, showering him with dirt. In 18 to 23, 2 Samuel 19, 18 to 23, you have another encounter with Shimei. When David returns to Jerusalem, you read, Shimei crossed the Jordan and fell prostrate before the king and said, may my Lord not hold me guilty. Do not remember how your servant did wrong on the day my Lord the king left Jerusalem. May the king put it out of his mind. For I, your servant, know that I have sinned, but today I have come here as the first of the whole house of Joseph to come down and meet my lord the king. Abishai, son of Zeruiah, said, shouldn't Shimei be put to death for this? He cursed the Lord's anointed. David replied, what do you and I have in common, you sons of Zeruiah? This day you have become my adversary. Should anyone be put to death in Israel today? Do I not know that today I am king over Israel? So the king said to Shimei, you shall not die. And the king promised him on oath. Now, David at that time refused to let his men take any action against Shimei. But I think at the point where David gives this instruction to Solomon, it has become clear in the meantime that Shimei's curse was not from the Lord. And David then instructs Solomon to take action against him. I think the basis for that is rooted back in Exodus 22:28. In Exodus 22:28, you read, do not blaspheme God or curse the ruler of your people. Exodus 22:28. In 1 Kings 21:10, where you're in the context of the controversy between Ahab and Naboth, where Ahab wanted Naboth's vineyard, and Jezebel arranges for this phony trial to be held to accuse Jezebel. Notice verse 10 of that chapter. She wrote these letters and says in the letters, seek two scoundrels opposite him and have them testify that he has cursed both God and the king. Then take him out and stone him to death. In other words, cursing God and the king was something for which someone would pay with his life. Shimei had cursed the king. He had cursed David. And I think this should not be viewed as personal revenge of David on Shimei, just because Shimei cursed him and that offended him. I think it's part of David's political testament given to ensure confirmation of Solomon's kingship, and something that was done to protect the office that Solomon would assume on the basis of the law of God. Yeah.
I think it was the 1 Kings 19 where David promised Shimei with an oath that he would kill him.
Yeah.
What were the circumstances?
Well, I say that was just in the context of that time when David was returning to Jerusalem. Now, that does seem to create somewhat of a tension between what he said then and what he tells Solomon later. But it seems to me that perhaps the explanation for that is that it's clear by this time that the cursing was not a curse from the Lord. David, in one sense, was a man of blood. And in that first passage, 2 Samuel 6, let's see, 16, is it? So he says, David says in verse 10, if he is cursing because the Lord said to him, curse David, who can ask why did he do this? See, it seems at that point David isn't altogether certain. Maybe this curse is valid. Maybe the Lord is telling him to curse. And it becomes obvious later that curse was not of the Lord. It was out of Shammai's own heart. It wasn't something that the Lord was speaking through Shammai. All right, so those instructions are given with respect to those three individuals. That's in verses 5 through 12. In 13 to 46... That's number two on your outline. If you look at that outline, under A, one is Solomon's succession to the throne. 1:1 to 2:12, that's what we just looked at. Two is Solomon's throne consolidated. Chapter 2, verses 13 to 46. There are two subsections in that passage from verses 13 to 46. The first one is 13 to 35. And in 13 to 35, Solomon takes action against Adonijah and his two supporters, Abiathar and Joab. And the context for that is Adonijah requests to have Abishag as a wife. Now, Abishag was that woman who had been secured to keep David warm in his old age. And you read in 13 to 35 of chapter 2 that Adonijah, through Bathsheba, requests of Solomon that he may take Abishag as a wife. You see in verse 17. So please ask King Solomon, he will not refuse you, to give me Abishag the Shunammite as my wife. Very well, Bathsheba replied. I will speak to the king. She goes to Solomon and says she has this request. She says, verse 21, let Abishag the Shunammite be given in marriage to your brother Adonijah. Notice Solomon's response. Solomon answered his mother, why do you request Abishag the Shunammite for Adonijah? You might as well request the kingdom for him. After all, he's my older brother. Yes, for him and for Abiathar the priest and Joab son of Zeruiah. I think Solomon recognized that request given through Bathsheba was another attempt to gain the throne. I have a note here in the... NIV Study Bible on verse 22. On that phrase, you might as well request the kingdom for him. Solomon immediately understood Adonijah's request as another attempt to gain the throne. Possession of the royal harem was widely regarded as signifying the right of succession. though Abishag was a virgin, she would be regarded by the people as belonging to David's harem. So marriage to Abishag would strengthen Adonijah's claim to the throne. So Solomon then takes immediate action, and Adonijah is put to death, Abiathar is removed from the priesthood, and Joab is also put to death. That's in that section, verses 13 to 35. Yeah.
I have a couple of questions here. Mm-hmm. How is it that Bathsheba didn't realize that
you would think so. I don't know how you explain that. I don't know. She seems there to be innocent of that, it seems to me, and just willing to make that request, not apparently seeing any significance to it, and Solomon immediately sees the scheme behind it. I don't know how to explain that, but it does seem that she's innocent of attaching any political significance to the request. Seems like it's just a harmless thing.
Yeah. Would it have been in verse 16 that some kind of a word?
Would that be like an oath? Perhaps not. No, I would understand that simply as a request. You know, you go to someone and say, "Will you really do this favor for me?" He's just asking a favor. And she says, "Yeah, she'll do that."
Are you going to comment a little bit on this? Joab grabbed the horns at the altar. That signifies a position of refuge, a point of refuge. How is that different from the cities of refuge that were established?
I think the principle would be the same. But those cities of refuge, or the horns of the altar, were really only for people who were innocent of deliberate murder. In other words, there was killing, accidental killing in certain situations for which the death penalty was not warranted, for which there would be refuge. And I think the cities of refuge were provided for that. The horns of the altar would have been an alternative to one of those cities. Functioned in the same way. Yeah. The note here in the NIV study Bible says the right of asylum was extended only to those who accidentally caused someone's death. Solomon was justified in denying this right to Joab, not only for his complicity in Adonijah's conspiracy, but also for his murder of Abner and Amasa.
Mm-hmm.
The distinction is made. Mm-hmm. All right, the second thing is in verses 36 to 46a. 36 to 46a. And that's where Solomon takes action against Shimei. He had made an agreement with Shimei to remain in Jerusalem. And then Shimei, when some of his servants left him, he went out to search for them and left Jerusalem and broke that agreement. And for that, then he was put to death. I'm not going to go into details of that. But you notice the conclusion of the chapter, which is 46b. The kingdom was now firmly established in Solomon's hands. That really concludes this first section. Your outline, that's That's A, introductory material, chapters 1 and 2. The central idea in those two chapters is that the Lord is at work to establish Solomon on the throne of his father David. And his kingdom is now firmly established. He is the one that the Lord had chosen to continue the Davidic dynasty. And he now assumes that position. I'm not going to comment on C. Or my outline is wrong here. I skipped a B for some reason. I'm not going to comment on B or C. B isn't there. And chapter 3 is a chapter on Solomon's wisdom. We're going to come back to that later because that subject comes up again later. But chapter 3 is where Solomon asks for wisdom. And then you have that illustration of the two women who claim that with the two children, one is dead and one's alive. And Solomon adjudicates that in a very wise way. That's chapter 3, but I'm not going to comment on that. I want to go on to 4, which is D on your outline. Solomon's reign characterized. If you glance at chapter 4, you notice it's a chapter with a lot of lists, statistics. Usually not the kind of thing you find very exciting reading. It begins in verses 2 to 6 with a list of the chief officials of the court. These were Solomon's chief officials, and you have a whole list there. And then that's followed in verses 7 through 19 with a list of the 12 district governors. Seems clear that Solomon set up an organization, a national organization with governors over 12 distinct territories. The purpose of that, you read in verse 7, he had 12 district governors over all Israel who supplied provisions for the king and the royal household. Each one had to provide supplies for 1 month in a year. So here you have these 12 governors, 12 districts. And it was the responsibility of one of those districts every month to provide for the maintenance of the royal household, the court. And then when you get down further in the chapter, you find details about the kinds of provisions that are needed to meet the needs of the court. Look at verse 22. Solomon's daily provisions were 30 cores of fine flour, 60 cores of meal. This is daily. 10 head of stall-fed cattle, 20 of pasture-fed cattle, 100 sheep and goats, as well as deer and gazelles, roebucks, choice fowl. Verse 27, the district officers, each in his month, supplied provisions for King Solomon and all the kings of the king's table. They saw to it that nothing was lacking. They brought their quotas of barley and straw for the chariot horses and the other horses, and there were a lot of them. Verse 26 says 4,000 stalls for chariot horses, 12,000 horses. Now, as you look behind the surface of those lists and statistics, I think there's some things we might notice. First, if you look at the 12 districts whose governors are named, you notice that the districts do not directly coincide with the 12 tribes, with the tribal areas. If you glance down through that list, you'll see that 6 of the tribes are mentioned. Notice verse 8, Ephraim is verse 16, Asher is, 18, Benjamin is. There are 6 of them that are mentioned. And then general areas of the districts are indicated. And it seems clear that in every case, it doesn't correspond directly with a tribal boundary. But the interesting thing is that neither the area nor the name of the tribe of Judah is mentioned. Neither the area nor the name of the tribe of Judah is mentioned. Some interpreters have concluded from this that in Solomon's system of taxation for supplying these provisions for his court, the tribe of Judah was exempted. And of course, the tribe of Judah was his own tribe. So some have concluded that the tribe of Judah, in this system of taxation to support the court, Judah received special treatment, which raises a question of favoritism and, of course, potential for dissension. And some feel that's part of a number of things that later on leads to division in the kingdom. Now that's kind of reading between the lines, but neither the tribe is mentioned or the area of Judah is mentioned. So that may or may not be a legitimate conclusion to draw from that, but it's a possibility. That's one thing. Second thing to notice is that the taxation is quite heavy. As we read in verse 7, each district had to provide supplies for the court for a period of a month. And the amount of the supplies was substantial. See, if you look at verse 22, Solomon's daily provisions were 30 cores of fine flour. A core is about, according to the NIV note, is about 185 bushels. A core. 30 of them. 30 cores. And that's for a day. You have to multiply that by another 30 for a month. It's an enormous amount of provision. And that's just, you know, that's just the fine flour. 60 cores a meal, 10 head of small cattle. You see, 10 head of cattle. That's a day. So times 30, that'd be 300 cattle for a month. 100 sheep. That's 3,000 sheep. You multiply that. And also, besides supplying the court, they had to provide for his horses. Verse 28, they had to bring the clothes of barley and straw for the chariot horses and the other horses. And verse 26 says he had 4,000 stalls for chariot horses and 12,000 horses. So they had to provide feed for 12,000 horses. And that's, you know, this one of these sections, they have to do that for a month of the year. And then the following year, they have to do it again. They go on year after year. Now, it seems that in the times of Solomon, with the kind of prosperity Israel enjoyed at that time, that didn't seem to arise much objection. People seemed to be able to handle that and bear it without being too upset by it. But I think what immediately comes to mind is the warning of Samuel back in 1 Samuel 8, when the people first came and asked for a king. He gave them a warning and said, if you have a king like the nations round about, what's he going to do? He's going to take. And here's 1 Samuel 8, he's going to take of your sons, he's going to take of your daughters, he's going to take of your crop. I think 1 Samuel 8 begins to appear not just an imaginary danger. The taxes that Solomon instituted, it seems, gradually came to be experienced as a burden, and as increasingly as a real burden, so that when you get to 1 Kings 12, in 1 Kings 12:4, time of the division, you read the people say to Rehoboam, Solomon's son, "Your father put a heavy yoke on us. But now lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke he put on us, and we'll serve you." So you see, by the time of Solomon's death and the succession to Rehoboam, this was felt as a real burden. And the people wanted it lightened. And Rehoboam wasn't ready to do that. All right, so that's the second thing, this heavy taxation. Third thing, kingship under Solomon begins to appear more and more like kingship did among their surrounding nations. Kingship under Solomon begins to appear more and more like kingship did among the surrounding nations. I think initially it wasn't that way. When Saul became king, it seems that he had a very small organization. He acted more like a judge than a king. What court he had was modest. With David, the court becomes more visible and organized. It grows. David built a palace. David had a harem. But that proceeds further with Solomon. So that when you get to Solomon, his court and his palace and his harem are equal to the most important rulers of the ancient world. And you can see that by comparing the statistics of 1 Kings 4 that we've been looking at with those of the time of David. If you go back and look at the list of officials in David's court, it's a much smaller list than it is in the time of Solomon. You find that in 2 Samuel 8, 15 to 18. So the number of high officials grew significantly in Solomon's court. And the other thing that's significant here is Solomon's development of the army. Even though David was the one that fought all these battles, and Solomon basically was a man of peace as far as actually going out and waging war was concerned, he didn't do much of that. He built fortifications, he maintained alliances. But you read in verse 26, he had 4,000 stalls for chariot horses and 12,000 horses. Prior to the time of Solomon, the army of Israel never had horses and chariots. And that is significant. Because Israel, in that sense, was an exception in the world of that day. Other nations had chariots and horses for a long time. I think this is also related to how Israel was to be different. If you remember, when Israel fought against a coalition of kings in northern Canaan at the time of the conquest, the Lord told Joshua he would give these armies into Israel's hand. But look at Joshua 11:6 and what the Lord said then. These kings had chariots and horses. Joshua 11:6. The Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid of them, because by this time tomorrow I will hand all of them over to Israel slain. You are to hamstring their horses and burn their chariots." Now, the normal thing would have been to capture the horses and the chariots and use them yourself. I mean, that's always been the way military operations work. If you can defeat another army, you get a lot of military weapons and supplies that strengthens your own army. But the Lord told Joshua, when they defeated this coalition of kings of Hatzor, hamstring the horses, burn their chariots. If you go back to Deuteronomy, where you have the law of the king, and Moses says, when you come into the land and you set up a king eventually, these are the things the king shall do. Notice one of the things that he shall do and not do. One of the things is, Deuteronomy 17:16, the king must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself, or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them. For the Lord has told you, you are not to go back that way again. The king's not to acquire great numbers of horses. David had continued that policy, that of Joshua, and in conformity to the law of the king. Look at 2 Samuel 8:4. 2 Samuel 8 is the catalog of David's conquest. You read in the fourth verse, David captured 1,000 of his chariots, that is of Hadad-Ezer, son of Rahab, king of Zobah, when he went to restore his control along the Euphrates River. David captured 1,000 of his chariots, 7,000 charioteers, 20,000 foot soldiers. He hamstrung all but 100 of the chariot horses. All but 100. He kept 100. But that's not significant compared to the thousands you see of Solomon.
Well, he didn't do that bad, but he wasn't totally.
The law of the king says, there's some latitude there. The law of the king says, Deuteronomy 17:16, the king must not acquire great numbers of horses. Great numbers of horses. I'm not sure that the 100 horses was a violation of that. You might say David opened the door a crack. It's certainly more than Joshua did. But Joshua, of course, was responding to a specific command of the Lord. Said, do that. In this other context, it doesn't appear as a specific command. But I think what the point is, I think you see a shift when you come to Solomon. Because he has this large military force. And it seems to me the Lord did not want Israel to be like the nations round about them when it came to military organization and armaments. But with Solomon, all that seems to change. The NIV study Bible note at 1 Kings 4:26 that verse that says he had 4,000 stalls for chariot horses, 12,000 horses. 1 Kings 10:26 and 2 Chronicles 1:14 indicate that Solomon had 1,400 chariots, meaning he maintained stalls for two horses for each chariot, with places for about 1,200 reserve horses. By way of comparison, an Assyrian account of the Battle of Karkar in 853, about a century after Solomon, speaks of 1,200 chariots from Damascus, 700 chariots from Hamath, 2,000 chariots from Israel, the northern kingdom. So it seems that Solomon here has begun to follow the pattern of surrounding nations in building up this military force to at least equal, if not superior, strength. I want to come back to that later, but we're just looking at several things sort of behind the surface of these lists of statistics in chapter 4. And I think when we consider all those things together, you get some conflicting signals of what's going on in the time of Solomon. I think primarily the statistics seem to say that this kingdom of peace has come under the rule of Solomon. And what I mean by that is there's abundance. You read in verse 20. Look at verse 20. The people of Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand on the seashore. They ate, they drank, they were happy. Their lives aren't threatened by wars or foreign enemies. Look at verse 25. During Solomon's lifetime, Judah and Israel from Dan to Beersheba lived in safety, each man under his vine and fig tree. So that, you see, you get this idea of the kingdom of peace. They're happy. They're satisfied. They live in safety. And Solomon is a ruler with very great wisdom and insight and breadth of understanding. You read that in verse 29. God gave Solomon wisdom, very great insight, breadth of understanding, as measureless as the sand on the seashore. His wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the men of the East. So that in some respects you see God's blessing. It's visible. And you have this kingdom of peace under the rule of Solomon. But, like I said, there's conflicting signals. At the same time, these statistics raise some disturbing questions. It seems that the kingship of Solomon is beginning to be conformed to the pattern of the kingship of the nations round about. Taxes are introduced that we find later become a heavy yoke and burden. Question.
Is there any comparable reason to the author of the
could well be. Could well be. Now, you see there. I think what you find, and that's why I'm spending so much time on this Solomon thing, I think you see that there are cracks in this kingdom right from the very start. But taxation becomes a heavy burden. The favoritism shown Judah, if that's a proper understanding, is something that also can easily lead to dissension and dissatisfaction. The introduction of horses and chariots to the extent that you find it, that seems ominous, you might say. So these are disturbing elements that, as you read the history further, I think do show themselves really to be fatal, ultimately, to the continuation of this peaceable kingdom or this kingdom of peace, and ultimately contribute to its downfall. So that I think that demonstrates that even though you have a chapter here of statistics that might be viewed as mundane information with little spiritual significance, that if you really look a little deeper, there's a great deal of spiritual significance in these sort of mundane figures, lists of names and how many bushels of this and that. I think life is undivided. We don't live in two realms that have nothing to do with each other, a spiritual realm and a non-spiritual one. And this chapter deals mainly with mundane matters, you might say, but they do have spiritual significance. I think that's in our lives as well. You know, we can involve ourselves with all kinds of things that you may say have no spiritual significance, but that's a deception. Everything we do either advances or hinders our relationship with the Lord. And that was certainly true of Solomon in this situation. I see I'm over time. Let me stop here. We're not finished this section. I'll make a few more comments. But, I haven't been able to get I'm not certain what's going to happen on that as far as school policy, but I'll find out. Further. I questioned Gail in the registrar's office about it. She didn't know anything about it. So.
What's weird?
Yeah, it did go in there, didn't it?
There's something to do, I think, with the writing. David earlier got me thinking. Have you heard anything along the lines of his possible illegitimacy? Have you ever heard that? That advanced. I read that in one article that I have.
Boy, would be the basis of it. No, I haven't
done it. A fellow did some genealogical study and saw that. I can't remember exactly how it goes. I could bring in it. He just did a very sketchy thing about genealogy. Also, the reluctance of the brothers and the father to admit that he was there. They that with some corroborating things. Also, that arose out of Psalm 51, where it says, "In sin my mother conceived me," and it's a possible interpretation of that. I just didn't know if you had, it was, this fellow stated that the Jews held, at least some section of the Jews, maybe later, yeah, they had a tradition on that. I just didn't know if you had ever come across that.
That's interesting. If you have the article, I'd be interested to look
at it. Yeah, I can remember all.
Okay.
The fact that among the sins of the kings of Israel, their possession of Aaron is not mentioned. How do you explain the inconsistency?
The inconsistency?
The New Testament's teaching of monogamy and these figures of Christ, who foreshadows Christ, having harem without being pointed fingers by any prophets. Certainly Nathan could have say that was wrong, but apparently Bible does not speak on that matter. So how would you answer someone who asks that question?
The only response I would have is a relative kind of thing. For example, Jesus says about divorce.
About divorce, okay.
That, it's something that God hates, and it's not what God intended. Yet, in Deuteronomy, you have provision for the law of divorce, how to go about it, you don't do it. And Jesus says, for the hardness of men's hearts, that was given. In other words, because man is sinful, God, in a certain sense, accommodates himself, recognizing that condition, to ameliorate the situation. Not that it makes it right, but to that extent, you could say it's tolerated by being regulated. Now, if you could look at that in a similar way with Solomon, that is addressed, not so much per se, the fact he had many wives, but because it led his heart astray, which is a more important thing.
Right.
So it seems that maybe the focus is on the more important thing and on the relatively less important thing, but that doesn't mean that it's right.
Right.
I don't know if that's any help, but because that is, I wonder why there was not.
It actually began with Saul, didn't it? Kings having harem. Or did it begin with David?
No, Saul had it too.
Saul,
Okay. I thought of a diagram that helps clarify what I'm trying to ask. Based on what Poitras said today. Okay. The question from, all right, we got the idea that he is the historical amill, and this is the dispensational premill stand, okay? And this is us, the historical premill stand, okay? My question was this. He's moving this way. They said this is dispensationalist, they're moving this way.
Yeah.
How does that change their premillennial stand? Does that change that at all? Or are they also, this is the party. And this is what they say eschatologically.
Why are you giving it a master's in this?
I am not giving a master's. Is it the party that's moving towards the historical end? He's talking about the biblical theology business. Or is it that their premillennial stance in eschatology is moving towards an amillennial stance?
Probably some of both. But,
okay.
But in other words, they're not rejecting a millennium.
Okay.
If they do reject the millennium, they're not going to reject the millennium, but the character of the millennium they may define differently.
Okay.
And I think the tendency is to make it less Jewish, and to make it more, some sort of situation in which all the people of God participate.
And that's what these guys.
These guys say there is no millennium.
Uh huh.
There is no millennium at all. In other words, you move from the year of the church, present time, into the eternal state. There's no intervening period of a millennium.
Okay.
which is why they have problems with like the passage of Isaiah 2. Where are you going to put it?
Yeah.
Because there's no millennium to put it in.
Okay. Okay. So, but my question then becomes, so they're kind of shifting in both areas. But these guys aren't shifting.
Well, they're your...
Poitras,
yes,
he might be.
Yes, he is.
And
he
then,
definitely is. Because
okay.
he went so far as to say, how do you put that? He said he was still amillennial, but that he wasn't something in fact. He wasn't too certain about that anymore. Maybe there was a millennial.
Yeah. Huh.
So he.
Okay.
And the other thing that they're not doing, it used to be that all these kingdom prophecies,
uh-huh.
in the Old like Isaiah 2,
mm-hmm.
they would try to, some way, since there was no millennial period of science, they tried to spiritualize and apply them to the church.
Oh, right.
Now, he backs off that. He doesn't want to do that.
Okay.
He will take them more as concrete realities, but instead of applying the millennium, say that the new heavens and the new earth
mm-hmm.
are the concrete reality in which those things will be found. But you see, that is an abandoning of the earlier, more classic Amill position that all of these kingdom prophecies from the church.
Okay.
So he's back in the more physical, earthly categories,
right.
but not in the millennial period, but in the eternal state.
I gotcha.
New earth.
Okay.
Now, which is a great improvement as far as hermeneutics is concerned.
Okay.
Great improvement.
Okay.
But, see, like a passage like Isaiah 2, it says, in the last days, the mountain of earth. How can you say that the eternal state is in the last days?
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that that is prior to the eternal state. It's still in this time continuum that we're in now.
Okay. But he's not moving, they're not moving towards what I would say our pre-mass millennial position. They would move towards the in answer to dispensationalism and not in answer to us.
No. Yeah, but I
am
think,
I saying that?
I
right.
think if you see what's happened,
go
I don't know if
go.
I can diagram
ahead,
this, but you see what has happened is these dispensationalist premills have really moved more towards a historic premill position.
Okay.
So that when he moves more or some degree towards a premill position, he's really moving towards this too, I think.
Okay.
Which is where some of us
okay.
have been all along.
Yes, yeah, some of us. Okay, that's clear. That's good. Now, I do well. Good. Do you see this as a trend? You're involved in that ETF society.
Yeah,